Who's going to run this interview? That's the question.
This is Jim Groom. We're on DS 106 Radio, and I will not run this interview. I'm going to hand it over to Jamie. Jamie, thanks for having me here at Penn State.
For Teaching and Learning Technologies Daily Buzz, this is editor Jamie Oberdick. Jim Groom is an instructional technology specialist and adjunct professor at the University of Mary Washington, but he's also one of those people that a simple work title sells short. He's an innovator in educational technology with lots of interesting ideas and quite an engaging speaker. He brought those ideas and animated speaking style to Penn State on September 20th, where he gave a talk at Foster Auditorium. Prior to that talk, I had the pleasure of talking with Jim myself in an interview that was not only recorded for you to listen to in just a moment, but also was streamed live. Jim has a lot of ideas in education, technology, and how we should be combining the two, but I decided to focus on two distinct projects he is involved in. One is an internationally recognized academic blogging platform at University of Mary Washington, and the other is a very, very unique, some might say radically so, Open Digital Storytelling course, DS 106. You do some things that may be considered quote-unquote unconventional in higher education. Why do you personally believe it's important to be unconventional when it comes to ideas for teaching and learning?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. The idea of unconventional in higher ed is, I mean, it should almost be like that shouldn't be the case, right? Like higher ed should be a place where unconventional ideas have birth,
right,
where they're able to kind of live freely. And I think that's the case oftentimes with faculty and the ideas they're talking about. For some reason, when you kind of translate that idea over to technology or different ways of teaching or different ways of opening up access to that teaching,
Okay. Some
of the basic fundamentals about what is conventional or what is allowed and what isn't at a university start to break down in certain assumptions.
Yeah,
and
right.
So I think it's important because we're living in a space now where information is not, you know, scarce and people can get this stuff. And universities, rather than imagine themselves as that kind of stronghold of that stuff,
sure,
might be able to imagine of as the innovators of how to deliver it, the innovators of how to make access it, the innovators of how to kind of imagine their kind of relationship to that information and some of the unique experiences they have around it and how to share it out openly.
Okay.
So, I mean, unconventional to me is like, it's unconventional only because IT and the concept of IT has become so reactionary that to call it unconventional is just a way of kind of trying to deal with how IT has kind of choked out some of our ideas. And I use that idea IT freely, and I don't mean to say IT programs. I don't mean to say any one group. I mean the idea of technology in general has so many people freaked out that part of it is kind of reimagining, you know, what's possible with that space. And it's going to seem unconventional because, you know, for many people, it's a threat to the basic concept of what a university does and how they protect that.
So. Right. Okay. Now, one project that you are known for is the blogging platform developed at University of Mary Washington. What sort of thinking went into developing it? For example, is it a mainly educational platform, a social platform, or a combination of both, something else?
Yeah.
How did you develop that?
Well, it's actually, it was a group effort by the folks at Division of Teaching and Learning Technologies at Mary Washington.
Okay.
And it was led by Gardner Campbell, who always thought that the blog should be the space where you're thinking openly and you're sharing freely.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the idea that we came to it with. Now, we all had Bluehost accounts, which were like $6 a month. We all had domains, and we were just kind of knocking away at these places, like building WordPress, playing with MediaWiki. And so when WordPress multi-site, well, what was WordPress multi-user, it still wasn't, it was in beta, and few people could really use it. It was kind of like James Farmer in Australia knew it and did it well. He built EduBlogs, but not too many people were using it. So when it went 1.0, Gardner Campbell was basically like, let's try it out,
let's
install it, and we did. And it was not UMWBlogs, it was basically just for a department, the English Linguistics and at the time Speech, but they're now Communication. And we did it, and overnight we had like 600 users. Now, that was for independent studies. It was for the department, that the particular department. The following fall, which was fall 2007, we opened it up for the whole university, and we came at it in a very specific way.
Okay.
We said, you can use it for whatever you want. There's no dictates. Like, you can use it for a course, sure. You can use it for a personal blog. You can use it for a department site. We had no real kind of limits on how people could do it, and we thought that was important, and it was, because over the next year it went from no users to like 1,300 users overnight, you know, and we started to realize how people were using the space, and we could shape it to that.
Okay.
And so it was cool. Like, we really didn't, because it was a pilot, and there was no pressure, and it was completely underground. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a big release, and it's not like the administration knew what we were doing.
Right.
So we could just open it up. It was all hosted externally for $30 a month. Mm-hmm. So there was no overhead financially, and we weren't integrated into the systems. So we didn't really have to worry about compromising passwords and usernames. So we had complete freedom.
That's
and
great.
We just allowed to see what happens. And we really, that first year was amazing because we realized that people like WordPress. It's simple enough. They'll use it. And, you know, that's when we started thinking about these personal spaces. Kind of the conversation we were having here today at Penn State is how do these sites afford for all different kind of uses that we didn't even dream up yet. And allowing that freedom and saying staff, faculty, and students have equal access, mm-hmm. I hope would draw a kind of level playing field for everyone at the university to get involved.
Okay.
And not say it's just teaching. You know what I mean?
Okay, well, what are some specific examples you can think of interesting uses of that blog platform?
So we have a few. So here's one. Professor Emerson, who teaches in the creative writing department at Mayor Wash, she's really cool, and she's always willing to kind of experiment. So she has two sites I'll talk about. One is a very simple thing. Students get an assignment. Twice a semester, they have to review a contemporary book of poems.
Okay.
They have to read it, and they have to put a review up. And we've been doing that for six semesters. So now there's 300 posts that are reviewing contemporary books of poems. It's kind of like the most comprehensive review site for contemporary poetry. And the poets love it. Hmm. So the poets out there are like, thank you for reviewing my book. And students are actually getting feedback from the poets about their reading.
That's great.
Has become like a warehouse for contemporary poems review.
That's fantastic.
And it's highly trafficked. And it's a really good thing. And it's not like overtaking the class. It's just assignments that they do. The other thing that we started back in 2006 is people use this platform to create a literary journal. Okay. So in 15 weeks, they have to come up with a mission, come up, get submissions through like Facebook, MySpace, wherever they go, Twitter, get that kind of critical mass of submissions, and then build a journal. And four groups do this a semester. And so we've all built that on WordPress. And so it's been fun to be amazed at.
Yeah, right.
We have students who are recording 18th century poetry and putting up there. And what's interesting is we found like students in Saudi Arabia are using that to learn English.
Oh, really?
Just like weird stuff that can't imagine. We have here's another crazy thing that we just picked up on. Students are going abroad, which they will, right? Students go abroad for a semester, a year, and they're actually creating blogs to communicate with their family. Wow. We had no idea. Yeah. No one said do this. Mm-hmm. But we have 30 of them all over the world. Mm-hmm. And so we're aggregating them into one blog and basically saying, can we do this? And so we have this amazing site. We've only had it up for a year with 700 posts from all over the world, pictures of students and what they're doing. And this is like, you know, you couldn't, if you tried to get this initiative going, like you said, I want you guys to mm-hmm. blog, they would say, screw you, I'm not blogging. The fact that we just saw it and we were able to see it because it was open and we would say, hey, you're doing great stuff. Can we highlight it? They loved it. And we weren't invading their space. And so that stuff is trippy to me because that whole study abroad blogs just showed me that students are using it for ideas that we wouldn't know. Like, I wouldn't know that they're using it to communicate with their family. Like, and to share pictures.
Yeah, I actually interviewed two professors here that told me that parents really like it because they can see what their students are doing.
Yeah.
I talked to two different professors who said that.
So the whole element of surveillance, even like so it's sharing. You can think of it as sharing or surveillance. But, like, what happens when you have your students who are doing great work and, like, one of the comments, and this happens to us often, are from the family.
Yeah.
Like, you see this encouragement happening in a weird way. Mm-hmm. That I think is enticing and exciting. But we've done a ton of stuff. Jeff McClurkin, who's a history professor at Mary Washington, actually has his students build archival research spaces. So, like, they'll research something like Technicolor film. They'll build a whole site in WordPress, mm-hmm. and then they'll stream all these different sites together. Like, we'll create a special theme. And so you'll have 30 independent research projects on a particular technology that we can create an exhibit right on our platform. And so the platform's been so malleable, and it's allowed us to kind of just see what people have done. And we really have, like, a ton. Like, we have professors who, like, are authors who have their own profiles. They map their own domains. It's just amazing because you don't know. Like, once you start saying, okay, here's how you can use it, someone else will come up with a new use. And it's like, wow. You know, I didn't even imagine that.
Right.
So it's cool just to watch them go. People are using it to present. They're actually doing their presentations with the site. People are using it to share We have a new site now that's basically a video warehousing space.
Okay.
It allows people to actually DTLT today. Tim Owens created this space that's basically a video kind of, how would you say it? It's like a video theme where you go and the main video is playing and then all those other videos are the episodes. So it's kind of like this episodic TV.
Right, right.
It's trippy. It's like, you know, however you want to imagine it, that publishing platform is basically the air with which we breathe to publish to the web.
Right.
Right. It's, you want to do video, you want to do audio, you want to do text, you want to link out. It doesn't matter what it is. That's the basic platform that you would use to get it out there.
Okay.
And everyone's using it.
Now let's talk a little bit about DS106, the innovative open digital storytelling course that you're a big part of.
For life.
Right, right. Okay. It's such an interesting approach to a course. Could you please explain it and what people want to learn? I'd love to hear this in your own words so people understand what exactly it is.
What is DS106?
Yeah.
Okay, DS106, and it's funny, it's like it was known as Digital Storytelling Computer Science 106.
Uh-huh.
The first semester I taught it, which was spring of 2010. And it became, the way I taught it was in a class, 25 students, and there was an online component, but it wasn't really promoted. But it became this thing where we were doing stuff and students were sharing it through Twitter and on their blogs, and I was like highlighting it on Twitter and other places, and people were like, that's an interesting class. And so finally, a Donna Gaudette, who was in Arizona, said, I would really love if you opened that up so we could take it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why is that the class focuses on people having their own space. They get their own domain and their own web host to start. They build their own spaces. And then that becomes the space where they publish their narrative.
Okay.
And the idea of DS106 is really, when I break it down, it's these fragmented, art-inspired narratives that they work on, like a series on design, on visual, on video, on audio, on mashups, on fan fiction. And they take a piece of that and they create constantly. It's like a constant creation space. And it's not the idea of like a narrative from A to B. The narrative is your constant narration of your process of creation. And so that's the idea, and it's on your own space, and it's inspired by Gardner Campbell's idea of personal cyber infrastructures, which is basically the idea that students should have their own space that they control and that they manage,
right,
as a way of understanding kind of the more intricate details of how the web works and how their stuff is shared.
Sure, sure.
And I love that idea. So the class is kind of framed in that. So what happened is when I opened it up, people went crazy. So I opened it up December 10th, and I was talking with Alan Levine and Martha Burtis and Tom Woodward about how to do it. And there's a couple of cool ideas that came out of that conversation. One of them was allow people to submit assignments. So rather than us saying, here's your assignment for the week, basically you have a bank of assignments, and people submitted like almost 200 assignments. And you'd say, this week, here's all the visual assignments. Take a look at them and pick three to do. And then people just go and they do their own visual assignments or their own design assignments, and they're actually not the assignments I've created, but the assignments that their actual fellow students have created, which to me is trippy. And we created a space, Martha Burtis did, whereby you could submit it through Google Forms, the assignment, and you could categorize it. And then once you do it and tag it properly, you can see not only the assignment, but everybody who did the assignment in the class.
Oh, wow.
So a student, for example, Colleen Trachey, submitted an assignment called playlist poetry, which is basically make a poem out of your, you know, iTunes playlist.
Okay.
And she did it, and 59 people from all over the world did her assignment. And like, she was like, what? Like,
yeah.
She was completely tripped out by the idea that everybody, it caught fire.
Right.
And so the student now is in some ways programming the class.
Yeah.
And I really love that idea. So that was one major development that I was blown away by. Another one was the idea that everyone have their own space, but we feed it centrally into this DS106 site. And
okay,
what was interesting about that is you didn't know who was a student and who was open online student. So what would happen is you'd write a post and 15 people would comment because you had this critical mass. Because we opened it up and we had 75 students taking it at Mary Washington for credit, and we had another like 300 who were just in the open playing around.
Right.
And so what that meant is students constantly got feedback from people all over the web, and they were immediately invested in it.
Right.
And that difference of, like, if you've ever taught a class of blogging, the hardest thing is to get people to comment.
Right.
But if your student, right, as soon as they post, has 10 comments, they're coming in beaming. They know that people have read their stuff. They see the value of this. And so DS106, when that happened, I was like, this is mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have that. add to that, week two, we're like, you know, we don't want to use Illuminate because we're tired of those sharing tools. You know, that's annoying. We want another way, an open way of sharing. In come Grant Potter with this idea of DS-106 Radio, where at any point you could actually share out your class. So we would do what we're doing here. We would get like an iPhone or a computer or a laptop and just do broadcast, and every class that we talked that we thought was valuable, we would broadcast out. And immediately people could tune in through DS-106 Radio. Well, that was the idea, but then people started playing music. They started sharing files. They started going crazy. We had crybaby casts. Everybody was just doing their own crazy stuff. And DS-106 Radio kind of spun out of control. And it did its own thing. And that was mint because that was its own community within a community that's still very, very vibrant. And so then Tim Owens, building on, I think, Grant Potter's idea, and this is like the class itself. None of this was planned. It's just emerging. Tim Owens says, what about TV? And him and Noise Professor started playing around with this idea, and then DS-106 TV came. And this was the idea that you could actually now video this stuff, and students could create their own kind of shows if they wanted. Now, it was late in the semester, and DS-106 Radio had already blown everybody's mind. So DS-106 TV was dormant in the spring. But we taught DS-106 again in the summer, and this was where it gets crazy.
Okay.
So DS-106 again in the summer, the idea was this, and this is a mind trip. So you ever seen David Cronenberg's Videodrome?
Yeah.
Okay, and
yeah.
You know Dr. Oblivion?
Right,
like,
right.
You are the retina. The TV screen is the retina.
Yes.
I was always fascinated by that dude and that his whole, like, McLuhan-esque idea that our real life experience is somehow not as privileged as mediated relationships.
Right.
I love that. And it's like, if you're going to teach an online class over the summer in 5 weeks, what would be better than to have Dr. Oblivion be your mediator, like be the medium?
Right.
So what I did is I shaved my head, and I just had a little mustache, and I dressed up like Dr. Oblivion. And rather than saying that Jim Groom was teaching the class, I taught the class in episodes of Dr. Oblivion talking to them about what the web is and about what DS-106 is. So the actual class became the story.
Okay.
And Dr. Oblivion was talking and droning on for three classes, and then he goes missing. And the students have to create narratives, and Jim Groom, the TA, comes in and starts saying, I don't know where Dr. Oblivion is. We need to put, you know, posters together. We need to start finding him. And then the class kind of like is like, what the hell happening? And then this ARG kind of emerges.
Yeah.
And then what goes on from there is Jim Groom starts to become this kind of control freak, and he starts banishing students in the class. And students in the class actually start revolting, and they set a separate class up called DS-107. And they start running that class, and then it realizes that it wasn't really Jim Groom or Dr. Oblivion at all who were hijacking the class. It was Martha Burtis, who didn't want it to be the TA but couldn't be, and she works with me too. So what we were doing is we were creating this on-the-fly kind of soap opera-like B-movie narrative for the class. All the while, they were doing their assignments and kind of getting their work done, and we were commenting on the stuff. But the whole idea of the lecture or anything like that went out the window.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it just became that's
remarkable.
A narrative.
Right.
And it blew my mind. And now Michael Branson Smith is doing the same thing because DS-106 now is changing that. Other universities are picking it up.
Yeah.
And they're doing it. And so we're playing around with a narrative right now called Journey to the Center of the Internet.
Okay.
And Michael Branson Smith is working with video and all students is kind of framing that narrative. And now other people can play along with that. And I love this idea, whether it's a narrative or not, that's up to whoever's doing it. But the fact that you could play along in these interesting ways. So
DS-106
has really become a community.
Uh-huh.
It's a class, yes, for the ability of creating community and kind of sharing and building networks. But it's almost now transcended the idea of class, and it's become a way for people to share and create. It's okay. Cool.
That's very cool. That's very cool. Well, you know, you actually answered my next question about examples of something cool happening in the class. That's great examples there. Is there anything else you like to add?
Well, I talked a bit, didn't I?
Yeah,
I'm no shortage of words. No, I mean, I have to add this, is that, you know, this could be framed through Jim Groom, you know, you've done all this kind of stuff with DS-106, but it's not really the case. DS-106 is also taught by Martha Burtis. Alan Levine was an unbelievable inspiration for us early on to think about how we could do this stuff and just helping students.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Brad Kosick, who's right here, you know, had some amazing kind of contributions. And there's contributions that a whole bunch of people give at different times to this community that I think hopefully starts to kind of blur this line about, you know, this is one person's class or this is one thing. A lot of the criticisms that came on early on was like, how could anyone else do this who doesn't have like, isn't like Jim Groom or isn't like in this position? And I think that's not the point. Mm-hmm. The point is, like, we have this ability to share and these ways of sharing stories that are kind of unorthodox. Right. And once we start de-schooling school and we start thinking of, like, learning as something other than, like, okay, here I go, you know, time to go under the dentist's drill again.
Sure.
But something where you're really having a ball, it makes all the difference. And that's what the DS-106 community is to me. It's like people are not afraid to share. They're not afraid mm-hmm. to have fun. And all the while, I think we're learning a ton. And, like, the sharing is happening freely. And I don't know if it's a model for all classes. In fact, I don't think it is. But I do think it's a model for thinking about what teaching and learning does online that other online, I think, programs haven't figured out. And that's the notion of fun and that notion of relationships and the interstitial spaces around the curriculum.
Sure.
That ability for a group of people to come together around ideas. And DS-106 Radio was really powerful for this because when you hear someone talk and you hear someone in their space, it changes your relationship to them. Like, you know, I always use this example, and I think it's a fun one. A friend of mine in New Jersey was on late at night at 3 a.m., and so was I. We were late in the morning. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I hear we're talking, and we're doing this kind of, you know, bullshit cast about whatever, talking about movies. And then all of a sudden, I hear his wife say, "It's 3 in the morning. What are you still doing up?"
Yeah.
And it just became that personal moment.
Right.
And that was really a different relationship to the space. I was in his basement. I was listening to his wife be like, "What the hell's going on? Enough with the computer." And for me, it all clicked. Like, you know, this is a very intimate personal space.
Right.
And we have the tools to make that experience around teaching and learning a lot more personal, a lot more intimate, and a lot more fun.
Yeah.
And I hope DS-106 is just one example of trying to imagine the personal, the intimate, and the fun around teaching and learning and the fun around what can happen with online classes, because online classes need a boost.
Yeah.
Right now, it's just like this drab, here you go, get your content, do it as you can. And I understand you got to get through, you got to get a degree. For some people, that's key. But for me, it's like, you know, don't suck the life out of the experience, because that's what's great about these communities that people pay for, even though you would hope they don't have to pay for them. But when you pay for a university community and commitment, you're paying for that that vibrant, kind of vital relationship to ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily something in the future, hopefully, everyone will have to pay an exorbitant amount for. And I want to think that models like this help us think of other ways to share knowledge freely and do it passionately. So if that's the bigger question for me, if it's even even for a second pointing towards that, then it's a success. Everything else is just fun.
Okay. You know, so. All right, well, great. Well, thanks a lot, Jim, for your time.
Okay, thank you. That was awesome.
To learn more about Jim, you can go to his site, jimgroom.net. That's a groom spelled exactly like the groom you would find at a wedding. That site also includes his very interesting and entertaining blog. You can also check out DS-106 for yourself and join in on the fun and learning at ds106.us. For Teaching and Learning with Technology's Daily Buzz, this is editor Jamie Oberdick. Thanks for listening.